Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is November the 4th. We are continuing in Parshas Bishalach. Parshas Bishalach. Right. And last time we got into the middle of 372, page 372. And we will start there. We had done the test, 19. I had mentioned to you something about the names of Hashem in these psukim. Let's begin with that very, very interesting observation. Pasuk Yutes, verse 19. Let's read the next three. Yutes, Chaf and Chafaf, 19, 20, and 21. It says, Vayisa malachu elokim haholech lifnei machane Yisrael, and the angel of God that was going in front of the camp of the Jews traveled. Vayelech me'acharehem, and went behind them. Vayisa amud he'onam mipneihem, and the pillar of cloud traveled from before them. Vayamod me'acharehem, and stood behind them. Vayavo bein machane Mitzrayim ubein machane Yisrael, and it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of the Jews. And it was cloud and darkness, meaning for the Egyptians. And it lit up the night for the Jews. And they did not get near each other the entire night. Neither camp got near each other the entire night. And Moshe stretched his hand over the ocean. And Hashem drove the ocean. Beruach kadim azah kol alayla, with an easterly, stronger, brazen wind, is actually the literal translation. They say,
strong
east wind. Okay, it's the brazen, it's a powerful wind, all night. Vayasem es hayom lecharava, and he put the sea into flight, and he chased away the sea. Vayibaku hamayim, and the water split. They say Vayasem Asayim Lacharava. He turned the sea into dry land or damp land. It says here in the English. Vayibaku hamayim, and the water split. So of course we know the Jews are going to go through it, and the Egyptians are going to go through and get drowned. These three verses, there is an interesting fact about these three verses, which I don't know if you have the same thing anywhere else. But Rashi, not here, but Rashi in the Gemara, in Maseches Sukkah, points out that if you count the letters in each of these three verses, 19, 20, and 21, Yotes, Chaf, and Chaf Aleph, if you count the letters, you will find, and I counted to make sure, you will find that there are 72 letters in each of these three verses. 72 in Pasuk Yotes, verse 19, 72 in Pasuk Chav, verse 20, and 72 in Pasuk Chavala, verse 21. Now, we know that Hashem has many names. There is the name Yud, and then Hey, and then Vav, and then Hey, that we don't even spell it without saying, you know, without making some difference in how we talk about it. We certainly don't enunciate the letters. We say it differently. We say with it as if it was spelled Aleph and Dalet. We say Ado. We have Elohim. We have Kael. We have Ka. We have Shakai. We have many different Tzfakos. We have all different kinds of names of Hashem. And we really focused on this in Parsha Shmos, where there seemed to have been, with Hashem and Moshe at the burning bush, one of the main issues was, what name is Hashem using? That was a very important discussion we had back then. But we also know that in addition to the names of Hashem that we know, there are also names of Hashem that we don't know. That there are mystical names of Hashem that contain all kinds of power, and most of us don't know those names. Even when Jews were in a better position than we are today, like in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, time of the Temple, even then, it was not something that everybody knew. In the Temple, in the Beis HaMikdash, when the Kohanim would duchen, when they would bless the Jewish people with the priestly blessing, as we do in Shul today on holidays, and as is done in Israel every day, and as is done in Sephardi Shuls every day. In the Beis HaMikdash, they would not use the regular name of Hashem. They would actually use, those who knew it, the Kohanim who would know it, would say the Shem HaMeforash. The Shem HaMeforash means the explicit name of Hashem. The question is, what is that explicit name of Hashem? What is that? There is some sort of explicit name that they would use in the priestly blessing, in the Birchas Kohanim, that we don't even know what it is today. We find that that name is used elsewhere. We find that Moshe Rabbeinu used that name of Hashem to kill the Egyptian that was striking the Jew back in Parsha Shmos. If you'll recall, the next day when he meets Dasan and Aviram, and they threaten Moshe that they're going to turn him in to the Egyptian authorities, and they say, Halahargeni ata omer, are you saying to kill me? Meaning, just like you killed the Egyptian with words, are you going to kill me as well? It was words that killed the Egyptian. It was that using the name of Hashem, that special name of Hashem, Moshe used it to kill the Egyptian. And we find other uses of that name. For example, we talked about this at the time that when, in the beginning of this week's, of this parsha, Beshalach, that when Moshe had to get Yosef's bones out of the Nile River, it was sunk to the bottom of the Nile River in a coffin, how did he get the bones out? He wrote on a piece of pottery, Alei Shor, rise up ox, meaning Yosef, and he wrote that special name of Hashem on the pottery and threw it into the Nile River, and the coffin rose to the top. And we also talked about how Micha, the young man who was not a righteous person, found that piece of pottery and used it later to create the Egel Hazav, the golden calf. When Aaron threw the gold into the fire, he took the pottery and threw it into the fire as well, and out came the ox, meaning the golden calf. There are other places where that name is used. We don't know what it is, but we do know that others have used it. We find in the Gemara several places where it is reported to have been used with dramatic effect. There's instances reported where David HaMelech, King David, uses that name of Hashem, and where Yeshaya, the prophet, Isaiah the prophet, uses that name of Hashem, and other places as well. One who does know that name is not allowed to use it just because, you know, I want to get my dishes done. Boom. Right? Can't do that. But those who do know it were able to use it under certain circumstances.
Also in the
Choshen, behind the Choshen. Yeah, well, right, the name of Hashem might have been in there as well, right? The name, the Shem HaMeforash, right. So there is some power to this name, which we don't understand how that power is used. We don't even know what the name is. However, there are several opinions as to where this name comes from, or ideas of what the name is. And these opinions may not be mutually exclusive. There may be several different names of Hashem, and I don't know. One opinion is that this name, Yud and then He and then Vav and then He, that we have written out in the Chumash, that we don't enunciate the letters, we pronounce it as if it was Aleph and Dalet and Nun and Yud, that's how we say it, that there is a way of pronouncing those letters that would be the Shem HaMeforash, that would be that special name of Hashem. Now, just so to make sure people don't get mixed up, it is certain that the way that branch of Christianity, that they use what they think is how you pronounce that name in the name of their own branch of Christianity, the Witnesses. So, although I won't say the word that they use, but that is certainly mispronounced. There's no question it's mispronounced. It's mispronounced for several reasons. First of all, it's not a J. It's a Y sound. That's because the J in Latin is a Y sound. They're pronouncing it as if it was a J in English. And that's for sure incorrect. And second of all, they don't have the vowels correct, because the vowels that we have with the Yud and He and Vav and He And in the stone Chumash, they don't put any vowels. They don't put any vowels in there. However, the vowels you will normally see under these four letters, of course, I'm not going to write the four letters on the board, but I'll write the vowels. Normally, the vowels you will find is a chataf pataf, which is an A. You'll find a cholam, an O. And you'll find a kamatz, an A. That's normally what you'll find. And if you plug in the four letters, 1, 2, 3, and 4, and you would enunciate it with those vowels, you'll get something along the lines of what they think they're pronouncing. But the truth is, that's just pure error. Because the reason why these vowels are what you will find under those four letters is because these are the proper vowels for Aleph and Dalet and Nun and Yud. If you're pronouncing those four letters, as we do, Ado and Nai, so these are the vowels for that. But these are not the correct vowels for Yud and He and Vav and He. That, the reason why they write these vowels in is just so that we pronounce the Aleph and Dalet correctly. But these are not the vowels for the Yud and the He and the Vav and the He. What are the vowels for that? We don't know. That may be the Shem HaMeforesh, that special name of Hashem that we don't know how to pronounce. That is possible that that is what it is. But that's only one opinion. And as I said, they're not necessarily mutually exclusive, but there are other opinions. Some say that there is a name of Hashem that is 12 letters long. 12 letters long. What name is that? We don't know. But it would be 12 letters long. Some say it's stringing together three of the four letter names of Hashem. Yud and Hey and Vav and Hey is four letters. Aleph and Dalet and Nun and Yud is four letters. And the Ekya, the Aleph, Hey, Yud and Hey that we had in Parashat Shmos is also four letters. And if you string them together, you get a 12-letter name of Hashem, and that's the name, the Shem HaMeforash. Perhaps. There is a Gemara in Maseches Kiddushin, in Tractate Kiddushin, discussing the names of Hashem, and mentions that there's a 42-letter name of Hashem. And, of course, we have no idea what that is, but that might be that special Shem HaMeforash, that explicit name that has all this power. And some understand that there is a 72-letter name of Hashem. And here we have three psukim, three verses in a row, that each contain 72 letters. So what is the significance of that? So the Mishnah says in Maseches Sukkah, in Tractate Sukkah, that when we had the temple, we had the Beis HaMikdash, then we know that on Sukkot, there's the mitzvah of sitting in the Sukkah, that we're familiar with. There's the mitzvah of the Arba Minim, the Lulav and the Esrog. We know that mitzvah as well. We do them today as well. But there's another mitzvah, which is the mitzvah of the Arava, of the Aravos, the willow. And we know on Hoshana Rabbah, the last day of Chol HaMoed Sukkot, that the davening on that day is very long. Yeah. And there, it's a mystical day, that day, Hoshana Rabbah. And in fact, some even have the custom to stay up all night learning on Hoshana Rabbah because of the special status of that day and the mysticism involved in that day. In the Beis HaMikdash, we don't do this today, but in the Beis HaMikdash, on Hoshana Rabbah, they would have a special ceremony using the Hoshanos, using the willows. They would have huge willows, very, very tall, with many feet high, that would go around the Mizbeach, around the altar. We don't really know that much about what they did. The Gemara reports some of it, and some of it we don't know. But we, on in the davening, on Hoshana Rabbah morning, we have many things that we say, many prayers that we say. It's mostly about water, about being blessed with rain for the year. One of the things that we say this really every morning of Sukkot that we say Hoshanos, is we say the phrase, Ani Vaho Hoshiana. Mm-hmm. We say Ani, Aleph Nun Yud, Ani, Vaho, Vav, He, Vav, Hoshiana. I'll spell that out over here. Ani Vaho. Now, Ani means I. That is a word that we know. Vaho is a word that we don't really know what it means. Vav, Hey, Vav. Funny kind of word.
doesn't seem to have any meaning. But even the word ani doesn't seem to make sense in the context, because hoshiana means help now, please help us. So we seem to be praying, saying ani vaho, this means something, please save us, please help us. Well, ani means I. I'm saying, I'm davening to me. I'm saying, ani, I, help us, help me, help, save. Doesn't make any sense. So the Mefarshim explained, the commentators explained that these two words are names of Hashem. Not names of Hashem that we wouldn't say. Like, you know, I'm obviously comfortable saying those words as opposed to the other words I mentioned before, which I don't enunciate the way that they're supposed to be said, because they're names of God. Here, there are names of Hashem which they're not on that level of name that we wouldn't pronounce them. We do pronounce these words, but they are meant to be referring to Hashem. So ani, which means I, can also refer to Hashem. Now, how could that be? What do you mean it refers to Hashem? And this word, vaho, which doesn't seem to have meaning, refers to some sort of name of Hashem. Where do those names come from? Rashi, on the Mishnah in Maseches Sukkah and Tractate Sukkah, says, look at these three verses. These three 72-letter verses, as he writes, these verses are all attached to names of Hashem. And what he says is, what you do is, you take the first letter of the first pasuk, the first verse of Yod Tes 19, take the first letter, take the last letter of the next verse, of verse 20 of pasuk Chaf, and the first letter of the one after that. So the first letter of the first word in pasuk Yod Tes is Vayisa, so you have a Vav as the first letter of the word of that pasuk. Then go to the next pasuk. The last word is halayla, so it ends with a hey. And then the first letter of the next pasuk is a vav. That's vav, hey, vav, vaho. That's the name of Hashem. And if you want to do some counting, the 37th letter of the first pasuk, if you count 37 letters, you will get an aleph. I believe it's the aleph of me'acharehem, if you count it out. The 37th letter is an aleph. If you start from the last letter of this next pasuk, from that hey of halayla, and count backwards 37 letters, you will get a nun. I believe it's, well, you can count it backwards. It's one of the nuns in he'anun.
Can you repeat that
again? And if you take the 37th letter of the third pasuk, you'll get a yud. And that's ani. And Rashi explains that each of these 72-letter combinations, counting forward in the first pasuk, backward in the next pasuk, and forward in the next pasuk, and string them together, you get 72 three-letter names of Hashem. Because there are 72 letters in each of the psukim, there are three verses, and if you do this whole combination, you end up with 72 three-letter names of Hashem. And that's a mystical combination of Hashem's names, which we allude to when we say Ani Vaho Hoshiana on Hoshana Rabbah. But it comes from these verses. This is talking. What would you like me to repeat? Okay. So you're welcome to count it out if you'd like. That is how it works in the Gemara and Sukkah, and that's what Rashi says.
Why 37?
That's a good question. I imagine because it's roughly the middle of the 72. Right? It's the second half of the 72.
Roughly.
The beginning of the second half. See, it seems that if you string together all 72 of these three-letter names of Hashem, you will get, according to some opinions, the Shem HaMeforash. That name of Hashem.
72 times 3, you're saying?
That's what it would come out according to this reading. That's right. That's right. We do this sometimes. I get the question in a moment. We do this sometimes where we have various types of prayers or things like that that allude to these names of Hashem. Those of you who are familiar with the prayer of Ana v'choach gedula simincha that we say on Friday night prior to Lecha Dodi, that also is meant to somehow the combination of the letters be one of those very long names of Hashem, which is why the custom is when finishing that prayer to end off with the phrase Baruch Shem Kevod Malchuso Leolam Vaed, like after we say Shema, because we have said a prayer that really the letters strung together make up the name of one of the one of those special names of Hashem. These are things that we don't fully understand, of course, but it's important to know where these names of Hashem come from, because that's what we're going to talk about.
What does the word hamafarish
mean? Hamafarish means explicit. The name, the explicit name. But I don't know, as I said before, I don't know if it's only one. There may be a few different types of names that we don't know that are explicit names of Hashem. The truth is, though, that some say as well that Moshe holding the staff, the mate, the stick, also has to do, as we learned when he did the Makos, when he did the plagues, Hashem tells him, take the staff with you, that you will do the plagues with them. So what does that mean? What does he need the staff for? So there are some of the Mefarshim, some of the commentators explain that when you're doing something supernatural, there should be an item that you're using to make it happen. That it's not coming directly from you, there's something that's that you're using to make it happen. The magic wand is clearly a takeoff of that of the staff of Moshe. Now, the staff of Moshe, according to Targum Yonasan ben Uziel, had the Shem HaMeforash, had that special name of Hashem engraved on the staff. So the staff itself, although of course the staff was just the stick, but it had that name engraved on it, which would therefore give it also some sort of power. And he's going to use it right now to split the sea. But so what do we do with all of this? Obviously, we don't know how to use the names. Even if we did, we wouldn't use them. So what's the relevance to us to be aware of this? So the fascinating thing is that these three verses therefore must have a certain type of significance if some sort of very long and powerful name of Hashem is embedded in these three verses. That would seem to indicate something very, very special. Now let me digress for a moment just to bring out this point, in that the Gemara tells us that the Torah preceded the world. Hashem created the Torah before He created the universe, before He created anything. The Torah came first. And the Torah was, since nothing had been created, of course, it wasn't a parchment and it wasn't ink. Those things hadn't been created yet. So the Gemara says it was an Eish Shechora al Gabi Eish Levana. It was a black fire on top of a white fire, meaning like black ink written on top of a white background, a white parchment. It was a black fire on top of a white fire that was in front of Hashem. What does that mean? Fire wasn't created yet either. So what does that mean? Clearly it doesn't mean an actual fire, but the Gemara is trying to bring out something for us to at least have some way of relating to it at all. If nothing was created yet, we can't relate to it by definition, because we can only relate to things that have been created. That's our frame of reference. So whatever that means, but the Torah was in existence prior to the creation of the world. The question is, or at least one question is, then how could that be? The Torah talks about events that happened. It talks about the creation of the world. It talks about what happened to us in the wilderness. And all kinds of things that the Torah talks about. If the universe had not yet been created, then how could there be a Torah telling events that would happen later that are based on people's decisions? How could the Torah, for example, say that Adam and Chava ate from the tree if they hadn't eaten yet? They have the right to make a choice whether they're going to eat or not eat. It's true they ended up eating, but if we truly have free will, the Torah can't dictate what we're going to do. So the Mefarshim explain that when it says that the Torah existed prior to the creation of the world, it does not mean in the form that we have it now. The letters are the same letters, but they were strung together in a different way that all were different names of Hashem. That was what the Torah was. It was the same letters that we have in our Torah, but strung together in a different manner that reflected names of Hashem. And then
after the world was created and the Torah was ready to be given, then the letters were rearranged or they were divided up differently in order to reflect the events of what had happened from the beginning of the world until the time the Torah was given. And then again, later on, to reflect what happened in the wilderness. So all of the Torah, according to this, has some relationship to names of God. The entire Torah, not just these three verses. But the significance of these three verses is that where the rest of the Torah, we see no hint to that. You don't see in any other verse something that jumps out at you and says, oh, these used to be names of Hashem before it was rearranged in a way that made sense to the reader. But these three verses, it jumps out at you. It's 72 letters, and Rashi tells us we even know how to string some of the letters together. So these three verses somehow have a stronger connection to the way things were prior to the creation of the world itself, prior to the creation of the universe. These three verses seem to be like a portal back to the time when Hashem was all there was. There was nothing else but Hashem, and it's only names of Hashem that can exist, nothing else besides that, whatever that means. Why is that portal here? If the entire Torah really is names of Hashem in some form or other, but here it jumps out at you. Here it doesn't jump out at us, meaning it didn't jump out at me had I not seen that Rashi. But Rashi is telling us it does jump out at us. That if you're careful to count the letters, you see it over here where you don't see it elsewhere. What exactly is being related here that is so significant? So let's talk about what facts are being told to us over here. So number one, the angel of Hashem and the pillar of cloud that was going in front of the Jewish people went behind the Jewish people. So it had been in front, now it went behind. Chazal tell us, our sages tell us, that what was the significance of going behind the Jewish people in addition to making it dark for the Egyptians, which is the next verse. But in this verse, just going behind the Jewish people. The Medrash says that the Egyptians were firing arrows and catapults at the Jewish people. They had brought their weaponry and they were shooting them at the Jewish people. So Hashem took that pillar of cloud, moved it to behind the Jewish people, so that
missiles,
thank you, would hit that cloud, and I'm not sure if they were absorbed by the cloud or bounced off the cloud, but they did not penetrate the cloud to get to the Jewish people. So he protected the Jewish people. We are going to learn much later in the Chumash that Hashem compares himself to an eagle. That he carried us on the wings of an eagle. Right? So the Medrash says that what's the significance of an eagle? Because an eagle flies higher than all the other birds. Scientifically, I believe that they say that there's a condor that flies higher than the eagle. And perhaps the nesher that is mentioned in the Chumash is not really an eagle, it's a condor. Whatever it is, we're talking about a bird, a majestic, huge bird that flies higher than all the rest. So why does it fly? And the Medrash says that the eagle, unlike other birds that carry their young in their talons, right, in their claws, the eagle carries its young on its back. Al kanfein sharim, Hashem carries us on the wings of eagles on his back rather than in the bird's talons. What's the significance of that? So the Gemara says because all other birds, because they don't fly higher, the highest, they are worried about birds that are above them that are going to swoop down. Birds of prey will swoop down and destroy their young or snatch their young. So they carry their young beneath them in their talons. But the eagle, because it flies so high, is not worried about other birds. The only thing the eagle is worried about is the arrow being shot by man. That's the only thing that could hurt the eagle's young. So the eagle takes its young and puts it on its back to say, I'd rather the arrow enter me than hit my young. So he puts his young on his back to protect them so that the arrow will hit the eagle rather than hit the young.
this is just a mashal. It's not it's a parable. But that it seems to be the way eagles are. Even though, of course, if you think about it further, if the arrow strikes the eagle and the eagle falls, then it's going to kill the young on its back as well. But the point is, the eagle doesn't want man to have access to shooting at its young. So the Gemara says that Hashem treated us the same way. Hashem said, I'm going to put my cloud between the Egyptians and the Jewish people, and I'm going to have them shoot arrows at, kiviyachol, so to speak, at me, even though, of course, Hashem is not a cloud, but at my representation, at the thing that I put there. I'd rather they shoot the arrows at me and not at my children, not at the Jewish people. And he protected us with that cloud. That's the significance of the first verse. So the first verse is Hashem says, I am going to put myself between the Egyptians and the Jewish people so that the attack the Egyptians have against the Jews will not be attacking the Jews, but rather it will be attacking me. I'd rather they attack me than attack my children, the Jewish people. The next verse emphasizes the difference in what happened between the Egyptians and the Jewish people for the rest of the night. That the Egyptians had it darkness because Hashem used that cloud to block out all light for the Egyptians, whereas the Jews had fire rather than a cloud which lit up the night. And the Jews could see perfectly well even though it was the dead of night. That's the second thing. And the third verse is that Moshe stretched out his hand on the sea and Hashem brought the wind that blew the water and made dry land, and the water split apart. The splitting of the sea. The splitting of the sea is the greatest revelation of Hashem that the world had ever known until that time. Not including, of course, creation itself. But since creation, the splitting of the sea was the single greatest revelation of Hashem that the world had ever witnessed. And it remains the greatest revelation that the world had ever witnessed, with the exception of the giving of the Torah. The giving of the Torah exceeds the revelation of the splitting of the sea. But in terms of miracles, which means a revelation of Hashem, where He sets aside the laws of nature and creates something which is clearly representative of some super being that is doing something other than the typical laws of nature, and it can't be witchcraft, and it can't be, it's clearly Hashem at work. The splitting of the sea is that event. The Gemara says, Ra'asa shivcha al hayam, the lowly maid on the sea saw mashal ra'asa nevi'im. She saw what even the prophets would not see. She saw a greater revelation of Hashem than even the prophets, even Yechezkel ben Buzi, even with the great revelation that Yechezkel saw, as we learned, the chariot of God, whatever that means, this lowly maid on the sea saw more than that. To the point where they were able to say, Zekeli ve'anveyu, this, they were able to point and say, this is my God, and I will glorify Him. Obviously, it wasn't really God, but the closest a human being in this world can come to witnessing something that announces there is a God was the splitting of the sea. Yes?
Is there any relationship between Hashem splitting the sea in Bereshis where He separates the waters?
Excellent. Yes. With this, the separating of the waters, when Hashem first created the world, it was full of just water, and there was no landmass, which means human beings could not exist. And then, on the third day, He parted the waters, moved the waters into specific places, and revealed the land, which now makes it possible for human beings to exist. With the great flood, the Mabul, in the time of Noah, Hashem reversed that. He brought the waters back and destroyed all landmass, so now human beings can no longer exist, except for that one ark, and then later, He brought the waters out again and made the land visible. The splitting of the sea is a continuation of what happened there on day three. It's moving away areas that had never before been land, where the sea had control. And now Hashem parted that as well, making new land for the Jewish people. The true land bridge
in history, was the splitting of the sea. So this was the greatest revelation of Hashem. When Hashem reveals himself with the splitting of the sea, he doesn't just reveal himself. It's not just that Hashem says, okay, I want the people of the world to know that I exist. So I'm going to do something that is so incredible, that is so supernatural, that everyone will know that I exist. He does do that. He does. But that's not all he does. He could have, if he wanted to do that, he could have done something that the whole world would have said, wow, that's impossible. There must be a God. He could have done anything. He could have made the heavens split open. He could have made, I don't know, he could have done anything he wanted. He could have made water rain upwards, and he could have made, I don't know, he could have done anything. He could have made mud fall over the whole world. I don't know, anything. But he didn't do that. He did it in the context of saving the Jews from the Egyptians. That's the context that he used to announce his presence in this world. He does it first by protecting his children and saying, don't fight with my children. If you're fighting with my children, I want you to understand something. If you start up with the Jews, you're starting up with me. Hashem says, he's announcing to the world, he's saying, number one, the Jews are my people. They represent me. If you attack them, you're attacking me. I'm going to put my cloud, which is the representation of me, I'm going to put it where the arrows are to show that when you shoot an arrow at a Jew, you are shooting an arrow at God, at me. That's number one. Number two, as I am attacking my enemies, and I'm going to make it dark for them, I'm going to make it light for the Jewish people. The Jewish people are my special people. I'm not just going to protect them from harm. I'm going to make things good for them. It's going to be bright and beautiful and nice. And then, even though it's the middle of the night, it'll be like it's daytime for them. Because the Jewish people are on a different plane of existence because they're my people. They're mine. They're my special people. I'm going to take care of them. They represent me. And I want everything to go well for the Jewish people. And number three, that because I'm going to save the Jews from the Egyptians, I'm about to save the Jews and destroy the Egyptians forever, I'm going to reveal myself. I'm going to split that sea. And in so doing, I'm going to save the Jews and destroy the Egyptians. That incredible miracle, the splitting of the sea, is in the context of showing the world that the Jews are my people. It's not enough that I exist, but I exist through my people. It is the Jews that make me exist. What does that mean? God exists independently of anything else. But what Hashem is saying is, the knowledge that I exist, that which mankind is going to know that I exist, is only going to happen through the Jewish people. For the rest of history, including Atlanta, Georgia, in the year 5773, in this year, right now, the only way that Hashem is known by anybody is through the Jewish people. Hashem says, I could make myself known without the Jewish people. I could just make a miracle and everybody will know I'm here. But that's not the way I'm going to operate. I'm going to operate through the Jewish people. They're my people. If you fight with them, you're fighting with me. If you're fighting with me, you're fighting with them. And they're the ones who are going to make my name known in the world. It is only through them that it's going to happen. And that is setting the tone for the rest of history. The reason why we have a throwback here to the age prior to the creation of the universe, prior to the creation of everything, where it's just Hashem, is because within these three verses, Hashem says, before I created, it was just me. Now that I created, so that I created a universe with mankind that has the ability to reject me, it is possible for a human being to believe that I do not exist. It is possible for that to happen. I created that. I gave man free will. included in free will is the ability to reject me, which is the antithesis of the way it was prior to creation. Prior to creation, all there was Hashem. That's all there was. So that means that's it. That's the only reality that exists. By creating human beings, he created people who have the ability to reject that Hashem exists, which is the exact opposite of what it was before. Hashem says, but through the Jewish people, I have a throwback to the way it was prior to creation. They are going to bring the world back to a state of being where everything, every person, every iota of creation is fully aware of my existence. So that there won't be any difference from before creation to after creation. That just as before creation, by definition, Hashem existed and there was no way to reject Hashem because Hashem is all there was. That the Jewish people will bring humanity and the world to a point where again, everybody recognizes that Hashem exists. That the free will that we have to reject Hashem will not be exercised that way. It'll be exercised to affirm that Hashem exists fully, completely, a total belief. And these three verses, which are announcing this special relationship between Hashem and the Jewish people, are also the three verses that hearken back to those names of Hashem that were the world prior, Hashem prior to the existence of the universe. These are obviously complex and deep concepts, and they clearly are Kabbalistic in nature. I am sharing with you the amount that I know. I don't know much more than this. We don't have the wherewithal to understand these concepts beyond what we're talking about this evening. Nevertheless, the point that we're making is still a crucial point to be aware of. So even though we've touched on clearly Kabbalistic and mystical areas of Torah, and we are limited in how we can understand them, but this much, it appears, Chazal, our sages, wanted us to know. And that is the significance of these three verses. It's an interesting thing that when they are read in Shul, there's no special attention given to them. Yes. They're read like any other pasuk, any other verse in the Torah. There's no special cantillations, no special trumpet. It's just read regularly. But the power that it packs is huge. Pasuk Chaf Beis, verse 22. Vayavau v'nei Yisrael b'sel chayam b'yavasha. And the Jewish people came into the ocean, into the sea, on dry land. V'hamayim lahem choma. And the water was for them as a wall, miminam umismolam, on their right and on their left. So it wasn't that there was dry land and the land kind of rose above the waters, or the waters were so depleted that when we walk around the outside, we're not in a we don't feel like the land is in a precarious place. You know, every morning there's a bracha that we say. One of the blessings is Roka Haaretz Al Hamayim. We thank God that He has stretched the land over the water. Because if the land weren't stretched over the water, we would drown. We would fall right into the water, and that's that. We don't think about that because we're not living on an island. We're not living near the ocean. So we're just walking on dry land. We think that that is the way existence is meant to be. When Hashem split the sea, He did not split it in a way that gave that impression. Mm-hmm. They walked directly through the water. The water was literally walls on either side, which is a very frightening type of way to walk through the water because, yes, it's not here now, but it's right next to me. And who knows, at any moment, it can fall in on me, it can cave in and inundate me. But the Jewish people went through as they were told to do. The Midrashim tell us that there were 12 paths through the water, one for each tribe. And the Midrashim tell us that there were all kinds of miracles that took place during the splitting of the sea, as would be fitting for this incredible revelation of God. That there were fruits growing from the sides of these walls that the Jews could eat as they went through. There was fresh water, even though it was ocean water that split, but there was fresh water to drink as they went through, and that it was not muddy. The ground was as if it were paved. They were walking through an easy path through the sea.
It was there were many, many miracles that took place during their walking through the ocean. It is noteworthy that it says that they went into the ocean, they came into the ocean, bayabasha, on dry land. So the simple meaning is they went into the area of the ocean, which was now dry land. But the Medrash tells us, the Medrash which many of you are familiar with, that at first they actually entered the ocean, that it took a few brave souls, not really brave, but the Jews who had strong emunah, strong belief in God, that if He said to travel, they were going to travel. And even though it looked like certain death, because it looked like they would drown, and they walked right into the water and started just walk through as the water got higher and higher and higher, and did not care, because Hashem said to travel, they were going to travel into the ocean. And they walked and walked and walked until the water got to their nose, which means the next step would have drowned them because they wouldn't have been able to breathe. And at that moment, it split. So it was Besel Chayam, into the ocean, Bayabasha, and then it turned into dry land. Who were the people? So the Medrash says that Nachshon ben Aminadav, the prince of the tribe of Yehuda, and also the ancestor of David, HaMelech, King David, he's the one who walked through first. And the Medrash also says that the tribe of Binyamin was also fully invested in Hashem and jumped into the ocean and also walked until the water split. So that's why it says it in this manner, bayabasha, in dry land, bisel chayam, into the ocean, bayabasha, on dry land. When this is read in shul, so here, the trough, the cantillation, is read in a different manner, starting with the words, v'hamayim lahem choma, and the water was for them as a wall, miminam umismalam, on the right and on the left. So the reader here, the Baal Kriya, reads it in the special tune that will be used for Az Yashir, for the Song of the Sea. Because here you have the first instance of their actually entering into the sea, and so it's read in that special trup. So, that's what the Jews did. Now, if you are chasing the Jewish people to kill them, or at least to enslave them, you're an Egyptian, and you are chasing the Jewish people, and you just went through 10 plagues that decimated you and your family and all your possessions, and you got beaten up pretty badly. And you really didn't want to run after the Jewish people, but Paro came around and said, no, we're going to run after the Jewish people, and finally he convinced you, he said, fine, I'm going to run after the Jewish people. And you chase down the Jewish people, and you catch them, and they are now stuck. Their backs are to the sea. You've got them trapped. We're going to get them. They are ours. We're going to get them back for everything they did to us, and we start to shoot arrows and throw missiles at the Jewish people. And this cloud rises up into the air and plants itself down between us and the Jewish people, blocking out all light, and everything we shot at them gets stopped. And it's pitch black. And it's all night. Fine. It starts to... And then, somehow, the sea that's in front of us... Now, I don't know how they saw this, right? Because it's dark. But Hashem must have allowed them at least to see this. The sea then splits into 12 corridors. And the Jewish people now go into the sea to run away from us. And there's fruit growing on the side, and it's paved, and there's water to drink. And the Jews are just... So, remember, also, the water is on either side, and it can cave in at any moment. So, will your typical Egyptian brave the sea. You gotta be a little insane. I mean, obviously, there are miracles going on here. This is not black magic. This is something way beyond anything that's been done before. And yet, the next verse tells us that the Egyptians chased the Jews right in. We'll read it, but we'll have to continue again next time. Vayudefu Mitzrayim, and the Egyptians chased. Vayavo'u acharehem, they came behind them. Kol sus paro, all the horses of paro. Richbo'u farashav, his chariots and his horsemen. El toch hayam, into the ocean. An amazing thing. It's really, really amazing that they were willing to follow. Now we understand it's because Hashem hardened their hearts. But a regular, typical person would not have chase the Jews into the ocean. It must have been a terrifying thing to do. And of course, once they're in the ocean, even before they get drowned, as we will see, Hashem is going to absolutely make it more and more terrifying for them. So we will begin, Mitzvah Hashem, next time. We'll start from Pasuk Chaf Gimel, verse 23. The Egyptians chasing the Jews into the sea.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.